As Caitlin already mentioned, our action plan is to choose the choice. In Alaska, we have a choice waiver program, but it's not satisfying the needs of Alaskan residents with Alzheimer's or other forms of dementia. The steps we have taken to get our plan underway are, we have spent hours upon hours researching and trying to understand Alzheimer's and Medicaid. We have written letters to the legislature concerning our issue. We have had guest speakers from the Alzheimer's Resource Agency of Alaska and have had families explain the disasters that not having Medicaid coverage has been causing. It is really hard for families to pay and continue to pay for their family members to reside in a nursing home. Our next step was to continue research on the policies on Medicaid in Alaska. Alaska's policy is as follows. Alaskans may receive Medicaid coverage for Alzheimer's when they need skilled care. However, only a nurse or doctor are allowed to do this. We would like to revise the policy so that you do not need skilled care to be taken care of, but so that you can qualify for community-based care. Recently in April, Anchorage was in danger of losing two nursing homes due to budget cuts. Thankfully, Alaska received money from other funds and the nursing homes are not going to be shut down. But wouldn't it be easier if we didn't have to go through that? According to Tina Foreman of the Alzheimer's Resource Agency of Alaska, a nursing home costs $83,950 per year, while a community-based home is only $34,000. So, really, we would be saving money instead of wasting it on a place some people may not want to be in. The good thing is that we don't have to rush into it and make drastic changes overnight. We can take our time. So the end of our plan brings us back to our beginning question. Why can't Alaska have Medicaid coverage for Alzheimer's? We can make a difference because we are doing something about it. Thank you.
Do you have a formal report that you've produced?
No, we have not. We're hoping that a representative from the Alzheimer's Association might be here to answer any specific questions that you have.
But my question was, at the end of your process, do you have something in writing that explains the what you found and the recommendations you made?
Nothing in formal writing.
Is that a part of what you plan to do? All right, and I would ask you to get one copy to Joel, and if you'll get one to my office, we'll distribute it to all of the legislators who are paying attention. And Joel, I think it would be really helpful if you could give us a little report back on what, on their recommendations, what is already being done and what is anticipated being done. And it'd be really neat if what these people have found, you confirm is valid, and something actually happens out of it, and we could get some feedback to them of what their findings and research have produced. Is that reasonable?
No, that's perfectly reasonable. I must commend all of you because I know I've struggled for the last 2 years to try to explain clearly to individuals the choice waiver program, Medicaid eligibility and activities of daily living and being able to meet the nursing home standard of care for waivered services. And so I commend you for being able to explain it clearly. I think your request of getting some type of formal document and then having the department give not necessarily a response but to amplify the discussion is probably a good one. We'd be happy to participate in that.
Yeah, I think I would speak for most of my fellows committee members is we would like a response. Sounds reasonable. There may be reasons why it doesn't work or federal law won't preclude it. And so kind of like to know, and if there's something that we need to do to assist you in doing not exactly what they recommend, but what's best for this group of patient clients, you know, we're eager to help. And so thank you. Senator Bundy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And for the students, the gentleman who was speaking is the Commissioner of Health and Social Services, so he is
the man.
I'm sorry?
He's the man.
He's the man that makes things happen.
And I have a question for the commissioner, if I might. Alaska is apparently, according to testimony, one of two states that don't have this waiver. I don't mean to put you on the spot, but off the top of your head, do you know why we're in such a small minority, and what would be required, at least from the legislative point of view, to change that and get us the waiver, if indeed that was the best thing?
Yeah, I'd have to, without answering your question completely right now, I'd have to look and see what the way we list the waivered services under our optional services under Medicaid and statute to see whether we can work within the existing authority or we need a new legislative language. That said, we would have to work through HHS through either a state plan amendment process or a waiver process with our federal partners, because they pay for the sizable portion of this and get their approval for such an expansion. Around assisted living is largely a licensing issue. And we do have assisted living homes delivering that level of care and caring for a large number of our Alzheimer's patients in the state, and that's the Pioneer Home system. For anyone who hasn't visited a Pioneer Home recently, and I run six of them across the state, it's overwhelmingly the overwhelming population inside these assisted living homes outside of Anchorage, particularly if you go to the Ketchikan home. I think you can count on one hand the number of residents in that home who don't suffer from some form of Alzheimer's or dementia. That's licensed as an assisted living facility, so we'd have to work within the licensing standards that are out there, and then also look at our state plan amendments.
Yeah, follow up, if I might. And then, if you determined that it was in Alaska's best interest to seek this waiver, is that then? I think I heard you say that action would have to take place at the federal level, or is there something that the state would want to do?
I'd have to check our state plan, which is agreed upon with the federal government, to see if we have enough authority within our existing state plan. If we didn't, we'd have to do a state plan amendment, because the federal government has to approve all aspects of our Medicaid program as a primary payer in that system. I'd have to look at our state plan to see whether we'd have to do a change or not. So.
It may be necessary for these people to then speak to our congressional delegation as well. So your job's not done yet. All right, thank you.
And do you have a card that I can get?
Not on me. I do.
And
Senator, thank you.
Would you get a card or something to Joel? And Joel, I'd really appreciate if you had somebody put these folks in the communication loops coming back. And Senator Bundy, if indeed some legislation is required on our part to make this happen, let us resolve to call it the Golden View Bill.
A Golden View Bill.
And
it saves gold.
Sure. So, thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator Dyson and committee, for letting them speak today.
Well. But thank you for taking on a task like this and doing the work and shining a light on where there's obviously a problem and solutions perhaps in hand. And we needed this kind of work, and you guys doing it is just really neat, and I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
I think we all do. So thank you. All right, here's what we're going to do. We're going to have a few more comments and questions and answers with Commissioner Gilbertson and Marcy, and then we're going to go into executive session. I anticipate that'll happen about noon. And for all of you with the media and in the audience, I'm sorry, we're going to have to excuse you, and this will be confidential information. And those of you that are on the telephone and the video net, I'm going to ask you to assure us that no one else has access or wherever you're at, because the information we'll be discussing is very confidential and is bound by all our confidentiality laws, and we need to be rigorous about that. So Joel and Marcy.
Red, I'm not, I may make it. these things apply, and maybe.
And ultimately, you come up with a priority response time. So when you say that a case is a
priority one, we need to respond within 24 hours. A priority two, I believe, is within 72 hours. And then a priority three is within 7 days. We need to look at those tools to see if they are still relevant. Our cases, because of substance abuse and lots of other issues in society, have become more serious over the years, and we need to be sure that we're asking the right questions and that we're prioritizing correctly.
Senator Guest has a question.
Quick question on that. Sure. Are we responding to all calls now? Tier 1, 2, and 3 is...
It's our policy.
Well, we are responding to all calls. Let's see, how do I explain this? I mean, some calls are for information and referral. People really just want services. They want to know where to go for services. They're having difficulty with their children. So we respond to all calls that rise to the level of being considered a report of harm.
Are there calls that are between, I would like information on this particular service and a report?
Spouses, visitation, you know, my wife wouldn't let me visit the child this weekend, or so we get a variety of calls that are not screened in, but we do, I believe, and Mike, I don't know if you have this number, we did 11,000 investigations out of how many calls, the total number, Mike?
It's 14,000. We received 12,088.
So we are
12,088 reports of harm, and we made 11,000.
No, 12,088 calls.
He just said reports of harm.
Oh, did he? I'm sorry.
That's the one and the same to me. 12,088 calls. Yes.
That were reports of harm.
That were reports of harm.
Right, which includes. Reports of neglect. Okay.
That 12,000 number is not the total call number. That's the calls that deem reports of
out to the Children's Place in Wasilla or Kowarik in Nome or CITC here in Anchorage, so that the families are assessed and served but not necessarily investigated.
Okay, and if one of those, the dual tracks, finds maybe
it should
substantial
be,
evidence.
It should be sent right
so
back to us.
Between the dual track and the frontline social workers, are we getting to every call that comes in that you deem
that rises to a report of harm? I'm certainly hoping so. James,
we have the informational.
There was a time when we did something called workload adjust. No, I have given the order. We're not going to workload adjust. So I'm hoping we are. And I'd have to.
But in your matrix, if I may, in your matrix, it seems like you're tiering them out in the tiers 1, 2, and 3, which I'm
familiar with in some regards, but you're also determining what type of call it is. Is it a call for information? Is it a call of report of harm? And then there seems to be this third one over here, which is custody and other things that you tend to get calls in.
Information and referral, so we call this.
Is your matrix only to go... What level of report of harm, or does the matrix assess, is this?
The matrix is simply to determine whether or not we respond. Or 7 days. And what we'd like to do, what the recommendation says, is let's examine this matrix to make sure that we are giving appropriate attention to those factors that might raise something to a higher level, that we're not missing anything. Is there
a matrix that helps you determine if it's a report of harm or not? How do you determine if it's a report of harm versus a custody dispute or versus a call for
information? It's done by the intake worker.
Yeah, that's done by some trained intake workers.
Okay, but there's not a set matrix. It's the intake worker.
That's the discretion of the intake worker.
Representative Gatto had a question.
And it's a safety issue. If you hear safety concerns, if there are safety concerns, then it's a report of harm.
It's so complex for me. A call for domestic violence. Mom and dad are going at it. The kid could be asleep. The cops come, somebody's got a cut. Do they call you and say, we've got a potential problem? And then if that happens, do you investigate?
Sometimes yes and sometimes no. If law enforcement responds to a domestic violence situation and they believe that the children are in danger, they generally call us and we do investigate. If, on the other hand, the children are asleep, as you said, the police have never responded before, they may not call us. They really make that call when they respond.
But if they call you?
If they call us, we would investigate.
So there's, here, three years ago, we identified the problem of the cops not knowing that the home they were called to might be a foster home. Yeah, you know, and there was something done to close that loop and make that information available to the responding public safety officer. Do you know how that's going?
Joanne?
It's going very well.
What did we do? That's not a policy.
We have had a number of times where the it's called the Absen
Project.
Oh, is that what you mean?
And there have been a number of times when we've been notified that law enforcement had an interaction with a foster home. I think we feel that it's working very well.
Yeah, so what we did was make the information available to police officers when they were visiting a specific home. They knew if there was a kid there that was in state custody. All right. Somebody told me we passed something last year, and I wasn't paying as much attention as I should have, but it basically said if there's been a DV accusation that will... It said something about that will influence the custody decisions, and some divorce attorneys said to us last year, be careful what you're doing. And now I've heard anecdotally that amazing percentage of divorce proceedings now have DV accusations that may be totally tactics to influence the custody decision. And you have not said, but you've alluded to the fact that some calls you get may be just spite and somebody trying to get somebody else in trouble. And I remember years ago when Governor Knowles put me on the Child Task Force working on this stuff. We had lots of testimony about bogus accusations that of child abuse, particularly child sexual abuse, and the difficulty of weeding those out, and whether or not we could prosecute people for making false accusations. You got any sense of what percentage of our calls are spite motivated or trying to tilt the custody child support decisions?
I don't have any idea. I don't think we keep
we don't investigate really that level good either.
We're probably going to change the way we record all calls in the future now that we have ORCA. But right now, a lot of the information on referral calls just get written down in a kind of on a paper log. So we'd like to go to the point where we are actually entering all cases into the automated system, and then we'd be able to see
what was happening. As an aside, I would appreciate it through your professional contacts and other agencies around to see if there are jurisdictions that are having any success at prosecuting false accusations. You know, we all realize we don't want to dampen people making calls, but we sure don't want to reward people making false accusations, taking your time and destroying somebody else's chance of custody or stuff.
Senator Dyson, Senator Guess, I know you're asking questions about the matrix or this or the decision-making model of how you, once you decide it's a report of harm, then how are you going to grade this thing as a priority one, a P2, or a P3? I look across our systems. You look at the juvenile justice system. You look at child protection. We have a number of systems in various areas where we use structured decision-making or we use tools to assess. And I think that while there's proponents for them and opponents to them, and I think the jury's out. I think what you do see, if you get above the rhetoric sometimes of using a structured tool versus a non, and there's reasons why you want a structured tool. You feel like you're not getting a fair shake for certain populations, for example, or discrimination in the system. I think at the end of the day, what you normally see though is workers use these decision models to support their decision.
As opposed to making the
right
decision.
And so I think there's always going to be a broad amount of discretion in the system, and I think ultimately that's required. We're going to have discretion in these systems because I don't think we want to turn this over to a machine. I think these tools should be there. They're valuable tools. We should use them. I think that, at least my personal perspective, is we should always expect some degree of discretion and acknowledge that ultimately we're humans making human decisions, and a chart's not going to make that decision for us in very difficult cases.
My biggest concern is there was a time where we weren't getting the Tier 3 cases. And so that's why I was asking. There are some particular cases in my district on the street I was living in that weren't being investigated. So that's why I asked, are we getting to all the calls that haven't been historically? We haven't necessarily had this.
I think there's something real workload adjusting.
I'm sure that we were investigating all calls. So that's what I was trying to decide.
Before we go to an executive session here, are there any other points you'd like to make sure that are out here for the general public to know and for the media? I appreciate being here to know about.
Well, we have the report available for the general public. I think one
QA.
One last item. You can talk about QA, and I'll talk about critical events management. Or
go ahead. You can talk about that.
One of the things we've looked at is the sort of the department-wide approach. I think naturally when you have a high-profile story, for example, in any one of our agencies, the gut reaction is to focus on that agency. Whereas I look as the commissioner of a department that has multiple agencies, where at any given day you may have 3, 4, 5 of those agencies providing services to the same family. How do you look across systems? Our behavioral health system, our substance abuse, mental health, maybe the juvenile justice system, public assistance, cash assistance. Many different ways we're interacting with these families, and how do we look at these critical events at a much higher level and look across the department for how systems may have failed? So one of the things we move forward with in the last couple of months is looking at critical events management and moving forward on a QA system for the entire department. One of the things we've looked at are peer review. working, bringing in the agency heads from across the agencies to all work collaboratively to address perhaps what might have been a critical incident in one agency and look at what are the lessons learned that can be taken across the entire system. So that's something that I think is moving forward is going to be a benefit for us. And I think that what we're also moving for is a way in which we can share information quicker across the department. We're a very large agency. And when you take something from a front line, and maybe in a rural office of one region, of one agency, how do you get that up to something that's like the commissioner's office or at a department-wide approach? And so we're actually right now in the process within the department of developing an IT framework, sort of a so we can immediately access, and you could put different, obviously different restrictions on who has access to the information so you don't, we don't share private information incorrectly, but a critical incident log throughout the department so we can use IT as a way in which we can share information quicker across the agency. And then also move into a much more structured response as an agency and as a collection of agencies to address these critical incidents. And so I think that's one of the lasting system improvements, at least inside the department. And there's a public benefit to that naturally. Well, obviously the most is that you get better services if you actually implement recommendations. Recommendations are just that, and to implement them. The second, though, is being able to respond quicker to questions from you as legislators. You can certainly call me within 24 hours. I don't always have the information within 24 hours. How do we share information better and be able to provide better information to the general public or to the media? And so that is another aspect that I think will be a benefit from that. And so while it may seem like a little tag on at the end, I think that's going to be a real structural change within our department as we move, in my mindset, away from an agency that runs a collection of programs that provide services. I look at us as one department that serves a population, and we need to wrap services around them. And what we've been looking at are where we can integrate services. Some of that was structured beyond that. It's how do you look at the entire department as a collection of programs that are serving one client, one common client, and share that information across programs, both in planning, in delivery, but also in QA. Downstream.
Yeah, I really commend that. We had a meeting here a couple months ago of the child advocacy centers, which I think are a significant piece. And I asked that group, what can we do to help? It was sharing information so that, getting the information from the people that are providing substance abuse support to a client and several other groups and so on. So ultimately, will you be able to go into your system and type in a family's name or a case number or something and get information to all the different agencies that are supplying service to that family?
Two issues. One is we're moving towards, one of the things we did that I know for the agencies it's been a tremendous challenge, but I still believe it's the right thing to do, which is moving forward over a period of years towards a completely integrated IT framework for the department. So move away from having one IT system for each agency, because the philosophy that I put forward to the agency was the data belongs to the department, the applications belong to the agencies. And applications are something that access the data and then spit out something for your use for actual policy making or for providing services. But the data needs to be brought together so it can be shared across agencies. There's a lot of issues out there, privacy, HIPAA, for those of you who work on healthcare issues. So there's things we have to work through in terms of protocols. But that was one thing where we shared data, and wherever you enter the system, be you come into a public assistance office, or maybe you become an investigation through the ORCA system, or you come into our juvenile justice system, which is called JOMIS, its IT framework. However you get entered into the system, it's entered into in a uniform structure, so the downstream that can be put into a database, which can be accessed from anyone, you can see what are we doing for this entire family, rather than what is this one program doing for this family. That's one piece. The second piece on critical incidents is designed in a way in which when there's a critical incident, where as it's logged in, and you again will establish protocols of who has access to one information, but between the supervisor, the director level, and then to the commissioner level, certain triggers flag certain responses and who gets access to that information. And actually, I could through the web-based interface, and of course it's secure, but through the web-based interface, then look and see what are all the critical incidents across the department. How are they being flagged? To some extent, a lot of the protocols are being developed by the individual agencies to determine what are specific events that rise to a critical incident for that agency. And that's still in development right now. I think we're beta testing one aspect, which is the least controversial, correspondence. You know, a legislator writes me or calls. How do we keep track? As you know, we get a lot of correspondence from you and your colleagues and from other agencies as well. And so how do we keep track to make sure we get a response back within a certain time period? So we're beta testing the system right now through this correspondence that's coming into the agency, and then we're rolling it out agency by agency and developing it around the agency's functions for critical incidents. A correspondence right now can be a critical incident, if you want to call it that, as a test to see information comes in, right people are notified, response goes out, and then take that to the next level of looking at actual events in our system.
Any questions or comments from other committee members here before we stop the public portion of this? Senator Guest?
Since we're wrapping up, I'll just, I guess, make a request. We only discussed two benchmarks out of 246. I would actually love it if you have an electronic medium. I would love to actually see what the other benchmarks are and where we are.
Yep.
I have one copy with me. But I'm happy.
And we can provide it electronically to the committee as well.
Yeah, I think
that would be wonderful. And I would also, at some point, like a better definition of what repeat child maltreatment is and what the denominator is, kind of what's the universe we're looking at, and what's the national standard for that. Just to request for the future so we don't take up time.
Any other questions, Peggy? Nancy?
Senator Dyson, this is Nancy Dahlstrom. I would just like to thank everybody that participated in the meetings today, and I'm sure your staff is already on top of this, but I look forward to having the information pouched to my office that was presented today in a form of paper. Anything that we were not able to have online would be great.
I will hand carry it.
That would be wonderful, because my notes are incomplete, especially when they were going through the percentages and what each one actually, what the percentage signified. So,
Representative Seaton.
Thanks, Fred. I did have one question. You know, I really appreciate trying to go from paper to web-based system, but I've got reports from both Homer and Seward of difficulty with the system, and I don't know if it's just that they're 56K, but it's taking, you know, 3 to 4 minutes just to go from one page to another. In fact, in Seward, they have they just have a hard time getting enough of the information into the system on complex cases. And so I don't know if that's just an IT problem or what, but I just wanted Joel and others to be aware that there are problems with that system in a more rural communities. I don't know if it's even worse out in the bush, but the system has some glitches that need to be resolved to make it work for everybody.
Yeah, thank you. Mark, are you still on?
Yeah, I'm here, Senator Dyson. The only request I have would be similar to what Representative Nancy Dahlstrom had, was to try and get some of this information back on paper. Thank you, Fred.
Yeah, and we've been joined by Representative Cisna. Thank you. Anybody else out on the telephone net or the video?
I have one final question, Fred. Yes, the question is, I have constituents quite frequently that when the non-custodial parent is making payments, and it's very confusing for them. Every time they call in, they get somebody different, and lots of times they get different answers. And so they get very confused at how much they owe, and especially if they're behind, is because of the data that the ORCRA and everything that's going to be in place now, is that going to be a lot easier to deal with Are we looking at an improvement in that area?
Representative Wilson, this is Joel Gilbertson. Child support enforcement is actually the Department of Revenue. So that doesn't go through our ORCA system, but it probably raises a good point, though, about how we can try and work, at least at the state level, to integrate these systems more. Well, it's still a good point.
I'd like to make a comment on that. Whether it's fortunate or unfortunate, I have had the opportunity of working with the Child Support Enforcement Agency in my own personal life, and I will tell you that the system that folks dial into is an automated computerized system. Now, sometimes the system goes down. Sometimes you have to wait 24 hours for information to be updated. But I will share that I personally never had an experience where I called there and received conflicting information on money that was owed or had been paid. So I would like to add that for the record.
All right. I'm a little bit conscious of your time. I don't want to cut anybody off. Representative Guerra, you had a question?
Just the remaining question on what the social worker child ratio is in permanency and foster care workers and in abuse investigation cases, what it is now compared to what the benchmark standard is. And you were going to look that up.
Yeah, we'll get it.
I actually have that for you.
Those are the standards. I think it's also how do we measure in each one of those categories? I think it's also part of that question, right?
You're going to give us the information?
Yeah, we
will.
Okay. All right. I'm going to take a little executive privilege here and just kind of speak to my fellow legislators. Every call that we get is not necessarily a valid one. And many people who call in with complaints will call a number of legislative offices. I would encourage all of us as legislators to always say, have you talked to the legislator from your district? Who else have you talked to? And try to, if we as legislators are going to make an inquiry, have it be one inquiry rather than having the department responding to a dozen of them. And just to kind of focus it and let these people do their main job, which is looking after the kids, not patting us on the head and trying to keep us off their backs. We have a legitimate reason job to look over their shoulders. Also, I'll remind you that Senator Kelly years ago got into law that a specific legislator who will agree to confidentiality can have access to the files. And I would encourage us to do that when you have real concerns for one of your constituents, or if their elected representatives won't pay attention, it often ends up in my office. But to do that, and the department has always responded, and it's a clumsy process, but there's real concerns about protecting confidentiality, and there's a lot of confidential information and false information in those files. The department handles that fairly well. But we legislators have that responsibility as well. And I would encourage all of us as well, when you get beyond dealing with a specific case and you see systemic problems, you know, let's elevate that up and get with the department and work on it and so on. But let's be smart and efficient about how we deal with all that stuff. All right. Anything else for the good of the order before we close the public portion of this meeting?
Before you close it, I just wanted to, I'm Lisa Diemer with the Anchorage Daily News, and just wanted to register a protest about a closing of a legislative committee meeting. I would like to know what specific reason and what the grounds under state law would be for closing a meeting.
Yeah.
And have time that we would be able maybe to bring our attorney.
Yeah, and thank you for raising the question. What we are going to do is the department is going to discuss some specifics of an ongoing specific investigation and what has been found. And that stuff is confidential, as I understand it, because of the ongoing criminal and perhaps civil investigations that are going on, and it can't be a part of the public. And I've also, Commissioner Gilbertson has told me that he is eager for some of the state's confidentiality laws to be changed so that more of the information could be released both to the press and the public and so on. But this has to do with confidential information on a specific case that is headed for adjudication. Is that basically accurate, Joel?
That's correct. And there's an attorney from the Department of Law here that can talk to Ms. Deemer if she wants.
Yeah, and I personally am certainly not interested in anything that not getting out. I'd love to have the light of the press shining in the dark corners. Representative Jewell.
Just a comment recognizing that we're going on other stuff. You know, for years, as I came into this process some time ago, and even before then, work had got started on the state's and the tribe's relation in terms of children and utilization of the Indian Child Welfare Act. And I know the tribes are starting to feel once again threatened. And I hope, you know, the resources available to our children and to the state are few as it is. They're having a tough time. And I hope it doesn't become the state's position that we alienate another resource in trying to deal with kids as it relates to how WIC was used, how tribes are utilized, and how children are taken care of.
Absolutely.
Senator Seekins has just walked in. Welcome, Ralph. All right. Anything else for the good of the order? Ma'am.
Is how the rest of the day is going to be going. I was under the impression there. I'm Megan Baldino on Channel 2. I'm sorry. I was under the impression there might be some testifying. Is that going to happen after executive session, or is no one?
No, and I'm sorry. I announced that earlier. We were not going to take public testimony or questions, but you could submit them in writing, and I would have tried to get an answer for them if I thought they were relevant. It was arbitrary. This is only the beginning of a long process here. And there will be lots more going on this particular issue of the safety of our kids. But there will be nothing more today for the public. So y'all can go home.
But, would it be possible to take a break so that you can do some of your things before you go into the session?
No. Just because of time, and Joel's got to catch an airplane. But we're not going to be in executive session very long. We'll try to get it done in 20 minutes or a half hour at the most.
So if we wait, then we might be able to grab some.
Yeah. Sure, you can try to get some of us to say something outrageous and worthy. All right. So I'm going to ask everybody excused. Those who are online to be able to assure us. Oh, I need somebody to move that we go into executive session.
I second it.
Representative Wilson has moved and Representative Dahlstrom is second that we move on to executive session. Any objection? Hearing none, this meeting is closed. We'll reconvene in 3 or 4 minutes.